Welcome to Kind On Mind, the podcast with me, Stephen. Today, I'm joined by Andy in Norfolk, whose life has seen him work self-employed in construction for the best part of 20 years, before moving into his current role in the local council, supporting homeless and vulnerable people, helping them to get back on their feet. Despite the positive work that he's doing, Andy lives with a rare condition called functional neurological disorder, also known as FND. And he joins me today to continue to add to the hugely important conversation around men's mental health. Hello there.
Hi there, Stephen. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
So first of all, I wanted to start off by saying that you and I don't actually know each other.
No, we don't. Apart from Instagram.
I think that I started to follow your account that advocates for mental health, and I asked a question on your story Q&A that basically asked, what encouraged you to start posting the content that you do? And from that comment, you posted your response, which you shared on your story, and I was able to respond to say how refreshing your perspective was. And although you and I have completely different experiences of mental health, our mindset isn't too dissimilar in why we decided to start an Instagram account that advocates for men's mental health. So from there, you and I have had conversations, we've liked and shared each other's content before agreeing to have this conversation. And I guess I'd like to start off by asking, at what point did you become aware that you were dealing with poor mental health?
That's a really good question, Stephen. In all honesty, I was completely oblivious to it for many, many years. I used to go around quite angry at the world. I'd feel quite down. I'd get emotional. And I couldn't make friends, couldn't keep relationships, just upset people, not deliberately, but I was a bit of a people pleaser and I would try to please too many people, but stretch myself too thinly and let everybody down. And I blamed everybody else. Then about 4.5 years ago, I had an accident where scaffold collapsed and I fell 4.5 meters, hit the concrete floor. And that changed everything. That caused me to have seizures, functional weakness, brain fog, confusion, kind of tics. I struggled with conversation, with getting words out. It blew my world apart, if I'm honest, Stephen. It changed my life massively. But during that time, I lost my business. I lost my home, ended up on the streets for approximately 5 months, which was frightening. It's frightening at the best of times, but while you're having seizures, not knowing what's happening to you and nobody believing you, it became very consuming. I got really, really low very, very quickly. But that made me reflect a lot over my lifetime. And it caused me to face everything that I've ever done, anything I've ever said to upset people. And it made me analyze me as a person, which at the time was brutal. It was hard. It was difficult to accept. But looking back, it was probably the best thing that's ever happened because I realized very quickly that I was quite an arrogant, self-centered person previously. And I would step on people to get what I wanted and not think of the consequences or how it would affect other people. But kind of being at rock bottom and realizing that I wasn't a nice person. Yeah, facing those home truths certainly changed me.
There's a hell of a lot of stuff there that you've just summarized in 2 minutes. A hell of a lot of life experience. And first of all, I'm sorry to hear about the accident that you had. It sounds like you're quite lucky to be in the position you are now, if I can say that, because you've got your physical abilities back. And I understand at one point you were in a wheelchair. Was that when you were homeless or?
No, just after. I was homeless for about 5.5 months. I went to look at a property. I didn't think for 1 minute that I would be accepted for this property because I think I was number 6 on the list and generally 1, 2, and 3 get the first refusal, but a little bit of luck was in my kind of favor and I ended up getting this flat. From there, my condition just got worse. Got to a point where I just couldn't walk. ended up in a chair, had to use a commode, just needed my partner to care for me. And that was very difficult because I was very independent, very outdoorsy, always the person who would probably fix things. Mm-hmm. So to have my partner kind of take that role as a carer, because the doctors at the time told me that I would never recover and it'll progressively get worse. I'd never work again. I'd never walk again. All the stuff that they was a bit doom and gloom. Looking back, they shouldn't have really been that negative without giving me an actual diagnosis. But the doctor was at that particular time. So yeah, it was very difficult on my partner, more so than me, I would say.
When you said that something like this happening really changed your perspective on life, that's definitely a silver lining that's come out of all of this. But when doctors are telling you all of these negative outcomes, which I agree isn't overly useful, was there any sort of positivity in you that thought, I can get through this and I can walk again and I will be more mobile?
At first, for probably the first 6 months, I just accepted this was my life and I was on a real downward spiral. I kind of would never get out of bed. I wouldn't speak to anybody. I wouldn't shower. I wouldn't get dressed. I wouldn't do anything. I was just in a dark place. I wanted to kind of, I contemplated ending things several times.
Gosh.
But because I physically couldn't move, it was very difficult for me to do that. And I was never on my own in order to be able to do that. And then I don't know why it was, but for some reason, I just thought, this isn't me. This is not the life that I want. So I bought a puppy and she was amazing. She gave me the reason to get up in the morning. She gave me a reason. She made me feel loved, I suppose. And she was always there, regardless of how I felt, how angry I was, how sad I was. She was always there constantly. Every time I had a seizure, she would pick up on it and she'd come and lay on my chest, which looking back is probably not the best idea, but she was only little, so it weren't too bad. And she just gave me that drive. Then I became more vocal, started talking a lot to my partner. And we started kind of planning, if you like. I think my partner, she accepted that she would always have to look after me. And that's no fault of hers. It's from what she saw and what she's been told by the doctors. But I'm quite stubborn. I'm quite determined. And I was adamant this was not my life. So I just started pushing. And the more I pushed, the more seizures I had, the more symptoms I had. But I'd rest up and continue to push. Then I'd start talking to people. I'd visit counselors or I'd find online forums. I found FND Hope. At the time, there was literally a Facebook page, I think there were at the time. But now they're quite a big organization that helps lots of people with FND. And I realized very quickly that there were other people out there like me and they were worse off than I was. So I just had that determination that I was going to get up and get back to normal. I think my driving force was going back to work because I felt useless and I felt that I couldn't kind of bring anything to the world. I couldn't see what the point of me being around, because I couldn't go to work to pay bills. I couldn't go out for a drink with my partner. I couldn't do this, that, or the other. So it just became a focus, too much of a focus, because I'm a very all or nothing kind of person.
Oh, I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah. But you have to be, because if you're a bit wishy-washy and you don't commit, you put things off to another day, I think.
Well, just on that comment about being all or nothing, it just goes to show that there's some sort of inner strength that you have, because with the tools around you, whether it be a new home, your partner, your puppy, you pushed yourself to improve. And although the outcomes have been more seizures and more difficulties, you do continue to progress through it. And in doing so, you've now got yourself a job within the local council, as you've mentioned, which leads to my next question. Had you ever seen yourself working in a role that supports homeless people before this happened to you?
Absolutely not. that's very direct, but no, not at all. I've been in construction for such a long time. I had in my head that is all I could do. You get used to the money as well, so you train yourself to think, well, actually, I can't earn less than that because I can't survive. But when you've got nothing and you're literally getting by on food parcels and kind of day to day, you learn that money's not important. Status is not important.
Just reflecting back on your younger years where you said you weren't the best person that you could be. That's the best way I can summarize it anyway. Working in construction, a male-dominated workplace where people are less likely to talk about their feelings. What is that like? And was that an issue for you?
At the time, no, because it's how I was. I saw feelings as a weakness, and I saw or guys don't cry. I grew up in kind of a mining community where unless you learned how to fight, you'd get bullied. So you would never cry or you'd never talk about your feelings. You'd never say you were sad. You'd never say anything's bothering you. So kind of going into construction, they were very similar sort of people. You'd have a laugh, a joke, you'd take the mickey out of each other. If somebody's a little bit sad, you'd say, come man up, get over it, you berate and all that sort of stuff. And I think if I went to it now, I'd struggle with it. I'd be arguing with people all the time because I wouldn't be able to deal with that level of what's the word without offending anyone. Yeah, it's just one of those environments that it's quite toxic without people realizing it's toxic, because that's just how they are and that's how people deal with things. It's, especially back then when it first started.
But without meaning to lead the conversation in this way, as we know how men are introduced to the world, they're encouraged to be a certain way and be leaders and be fighters and to not show emotion and all of those mindsets. Is there any surprise that a male-dominated workplace is this way?
No, not at all.
So when you reflect back on your younger years and you say you weren't the best person and didn't take other people's feelings into account, is that your fault?
Yeah, because I'm responsible for my own actions.
Interesting.
I think if you asked me before, I would have said, no, just how I am. It's how men are. It's how we're taught. And we have been for a long, long time. It's you're taught to hide your emotions and to provide.
I would say that if you didn't have that awareness, how would you know it was your fault?
Yeah, I have the awareness now, though.
Yeah.
And I never make excuses for how I've behaved. I accept it because ultimately, whether it's learned behavior or whether it's just circumstance at the time, I still make that choice. It was still up to me to realize what was right and what was wrong. So I think that's just where I'm hard on myself, if I'm honest.
Yeah. I think that's such a positive thing for you to say, though. As we all reflect on our lives and we recognize where we could have made improvements, which it's a great role model trait for younger generations.
Yeah, because we've all got our stories. You know, there's so many people say they didn't have the best childhood or whatever that might be, but we don't have to follow the same path. We just have to be strong enough to say, well, actually, that's not how it should be or how it could be. And then we just need to adapt. But it's just so easy to kind of follow the tradition, so to speak, because it's harder to push back.
I was about to say that it's so hard to change the narrative and to push back, but the way that you've done that is to share your story on a social media account. And you've mentioned to me before that you didn't initially share your face on that, but I guess my next question would be, what encouraged you to start that account in the first place?
The reason I started the account, I guess initially, was for selfish reasons. I was at a point where I'd been having trauma therapy. I was able to start talking about experiences that I've had. So I wanted to continue that. I couldn't afford therapy because it's expensive, as we all know. So I just needed to have that outlet. And I felt once I started talking, sharing my emotions and feelings, I couldn't stop doing that. So for me, having a social media page allowed me to do that in quite a safe environment. Sometimes, even to this day, I regret it because there's still that old me that feels quite vulnerable. Being vulnerable, and I have the fear of being judged every time I post or every time I say something or interact, or I have the fear of past coming and kind of saying, well, actually, you were a really horrible person to me, so how can you be some sort of mental health advocate? And I guess to those people, all I can say is, yes, I was, I'm sorry, I'm not that person, and I am trying to make a difference. I think it's just important to share your story so people could understand they're not alone. That is the worst feeling for me, feeling like you're on your own, even though you know there's millions of people out there, feeling you're the only person who's going through whatever you're going through is torture.
It's such a damaging mindset to be in as well. And just to touch slightly on you thinking of ending it, and you mentioned that you weren't on your own enough to do that. It's really sad to think that if you were on your own, perhaps maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
I don't think we would, if I'm honest.
As somebody like me who's never had the influence of a consistent positive male role model, to see yourself speaking so openly about what you go through is nothing but inspiring to me. I know you've had a lot of positive feedback, and I guess when you have those moments where you question your content and what you post, it's just about remembering those positive comments, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. And I do that on a regular basis. I do look over old posts and kind of read some of the comments, because I question the posts that I do. I sometimes think I don't do enough. Sometimes think I do too much. I think it's very boring, very safe. But I think that's me as a person. I think I'm just, when you're telling your story, your page is literally about your story, you're not going to be posting all the time. It's not going to be like watching a movie. It's real life. So it's going to be a little bit kind of basic, I guess. But I strive to be better all the time, and I constantly do not rest, and I'm always looking for new things. And I look at lots of other pages and think, that is amazing. Why can't mine have a bit of unison, or why can't mine follow a similar thing? But I have to remind myself, mine's about me and my journey.
Yeah.
And it happens to help other people, which is amazing.
Comparison is the thief of joy.
Sure, massively.
Massively.
But we all do it.
Well, that leads me to my next question. Do you not think that we all do that? Because I look at some accounts and think it's content from the most successful and high-functioning people, but perhaps maybe they feel the same as we do.
Yeah, 100%. There will be, because we do, we all do it. And that's why we do it, because we're vulnerable people who have mental health problems. So I think if we had a happy kind of everyday life and we've not experienced what we've experienced, we probably wouldn't have that kind of page. It'd just be a personal page where we'd be posting selfies of going to the gym and hiking up a mountain like a lot of other people do. And I get really envious of those people. But in reality, you only know what people want you to know.
Yeah. So, you know that the Kind On Mind profile doesn't show my face, but I have to ask why your profile doesn't show yours.
Fear. I was scared to death what people would think about me as a person. So I guess by calling it Supporting Mental Health was a way to dip my toe in the water to kind of say, actually, is it going to be okay? Because because of my age, I just saw social media as this monster, and there was nothing good on social media. That's why I've never had a social media account, because I'm just scared to death of nasty people who would never actually say anything to your face, but it's quite happy to do it on a keyboard. So I was scared, really scared of how people would receive me, I guess.
When you started that account, did you begin following people that you knew or people that were going through similar things? Because I think there's a difference between speaking to people that you know and to strangers.
Definitely not people that I know, because I purposely stayed away from people from my past. Because through my life, I've had a few friends, lots of acquaintances, but I never let people get too close. Whether I have that fear of they're going to hurt me or I'm going to hurt them or whatever that might be, but I never let people get close. So the last thing I was going to do was potentially follow people who might have access to my old life. So I just followed completely random people. It wasn't mental health related. I was interested in outdoors, climbing, hiking. So they're the people that I started following. And I think I started following people and liking content for maybe 4 or 5 weeks before I really posted anything myself. I built up like a bit of a core base, 1 or 2 followers back. And still to this day, I still have those same people as who I follow.
Yeah.
And I still check in with most of those people as well. One thing I have noticed with my page, everybody's so friendly and everybody genuinely cares. And that shocked me, really shocked me. But you'll get people, if I don't post for a couple of days, I'll get umpteen messages to ask how I am, just to make sure I'm okay. But I do the same with others as well. I make a point of contacting people on a regular basis just to see how they are, because I think it's important, because it just takes that one message at the right time and that could stop something that potentially would be life-changing.
These positive outcomes are probably what led to you showing your identity. Was it quite organic, or were there feelings in the lead up to doing it?
It wasn't organic at all. No. I read a quote. I can't remember exactly what the quote was, but it was basically say, roar like a lion, be courageous. And I thought, you know what? Sod it. I can't hide away forever. I can't change what's happened, but I can be accountable. So that's what I did. And once I posted my picture, I didn't look at Instagram for about a week.
Really?
Because I was scared of what people would say. But obviously, nobody cares, do they, in reality? You don't bother.
It's so interesting because you're almost putting the vibe out there that you think that people would judge you on your appearance.
Yeah.
And what do you think that they'd see other than a decent guy that's sharing his experience? It's quite a hard question to answer, really.
It is, because I don't necessarily think my appearance as such I'd be targeted. I think it's more how the perception of my appearance, because I have a lot of things inside that makes me feel ugly in myself. So I guess I assume or thought that would come out on a picture or on a video or on camera in some way, because you forget that people don't know you. They don't know what you've experienced or what you've been through. They have no clue. They only know what you give them. So for me to have that thought process of, well, ooh, I don't like myself very much, so other people are not going to like me. Mm. And that's exactly how I thought.
It's interesting because I always say that we're comparing our inside to everyone else's outside.
Mm-hmm. It is 100% mindset. I always believe that I'm going to get better. However that is, I won't just accept how my life is now. My life's okay. I can't complain, but I want more.
Mm.
And I worry, if I'm completely honest, that I'll always want more and I'll never settle, because that's a recipe for disaster in itself.
I hear what you're saying. I think that's exactly why we're always looking for more, isn't it? We'll never get up to the top of that pyramid of self-actualization, because when we achieve something, we then move on to the next thing that we want to achieve.
It's self-improvement. But at what point... I tend to improve myself around other people. So if something's not working, I assume it's my fault. So I will adapt and change how I am as a person and see that as improvement. But in reality, if you look at it and think, well, actually, you're just a bit of an arse. It's nothing to do with me. It's just you.
Yeah.
But I don't do it that way. I'd see it as, oh, it must be me, because it's always been me. So I adapt myself, which, yeah. And okay. I don't know. It's hard.
Okay, so you might say it's always been you, and that might have been the case, but that's definitely not the case now. And I think that's the right sort of mindset to have. The internal change that you've created over the last few years, it just goes to show that sometimes in life, it is the other person. They are an arsehole, and it's just about choosing how best to navigate around that, isn't it?
Yeah, you've just got to be comfortable in yourself.
Mm.
And it takes a lot, and it takes consistent work as well. It's not just something you wake up and think, oh, actually, life's great now. I'm okay. I'm happy with everything. I hold myself accountable. I'll say this, that, and the other. But it's just not like that at all. Your self-improvement is constant. You go backwards, you go forwards, you go sideways. It's tiring, but that's mental health. There's no fix.
But that's exactly why we're always looking for more, isn't it? Like, I don't think any normal human being wants to settle with that. Like, we're always looking for more, and we'll never get up to that top of the pyramid of self-actualization, because it doesn't exist. As in, like, there isn't a person on the planet that doesn't want more.
Yeah.
It's
getting that healthy balance.
Mm. What is functional neurological disorder?
In simple terms, it's a misfiring of the brain. It's almost like a computer, I guess. You're hardwired to react in certain ways, or walk or talk or however that might be. And every now and again, it misfires and your legs don't work, or you fall over and have a seizure, or you can't speak, or you don't remember this or don't remember that. It's just a misfiring of the brain. It's still a mystery. It's one of those things that are becoming more popular. But I don't know if it's more popular because medical professionals don't, if they can't find an answer to a problem, I worry that FND is going to get watered down, because they're just going to say everyone's got FND.
Hmm.
And that's a big worry, because I don't think the investigations and the funding will go to the right places then, because it'll just be one of those illnesses that have got in a bracket where everybody goes if they don't really know what's happening. For me, FND was seizures, or is seizures, blackouts. I just zone out, just stare into space for no reason. I have a lot of pain. The pain's always there. I kind of managed to deal with it now, but it's always there. In the early days, I was on tramadol, I was on morphine, or on all sorts of stuff to control that pain. But I just decided I didn't want to be a zombie, and I just wanted to have control over my life. And if I could feel pain, I'm alive. And that's kind of how I view things. And I still do, to an extent. Don't take medication unless I really need to. It's life-changing. But I've met so many positive, life-changing people with FND. And it's almost like a little family. And I still chat to people now. And if I come across something new, I introduce them to that, and they'll do the same for me. And we've always kind of got each other's backs, because ultimately anybody with FND understands what it's like to have that invisible disability. Because looking at me now, you would never guess I was ill. You would never guess that I'd have this disability that could cause me to be in bed for weeks on end or not walk. And that in itself was very difficult to overcome, from councils or the benefits office or PIP or work or however it is. People just don't believe you because you look fit and well. And that were a big struggle, I guess.
I think
I feel like I've digressed a bit.
No, you haven't, not at all. And I think that links back into your motivations for not sharing your face on your Instagram account too.
Yeah. I refuse to let people see me at my worst. I have been a bit more vulnerable recently. But when I was able to walk and stuff again, I set myself a challenge to climb Scarfell Pike. And I did that for Rock to Recovery because it's a charity kind of close to my heart. And they really make a difference to kind of military and blue light services, including the families. And I wanted to do a bit for them. I was adamant that dead easy, I can climb this mountain, no problem at all, backpack on, the whole works. And I did climb it, but not without like 4 tramadol. I was in intense, it was intense. I didn't enjoy it. I just looked at the floor the whole time and I just wanted it to be over. But I did it, and I did it for charity, and that kind of proved that actually you can do what you need to do, and when you want to do it, you just have to put your mind to it and push through it. But I had some really good, positive people around me who encouraged me, and I think that's what got me by.
So it sounds like you've really benefited from either creating or joining groups of people with similar experiences, and that's the benefit of having a diagnosis, isn't it? When we're able to attach to a label that another person shares, we're able to join together to support each other, have those conversations, create those podcast episodes, and support other people online, aren't we?
Oh, massively. Once you've got a diagnosis, for me, once I got that diagnosis and I was told that it's likely I've caused this myself by suppressing my traumas and feelings, I forgot about FND. I didn't care if it was a diagnosis or not. I was to blame. And if I'm thinking these things to happen, I can control that and change that. So and that changed my mindset completely.
So with that point, were you suffering with seizures before your fall?
No.
So what is their thoughts with regards to FND on mental health versus FND following a physical fall? I'm assuming that you weren't having seizures before this accident happened. I appreciate it's quite a complex question to answer, but I'm just trying to understand how it comes about.
It's like a tipping point. How it was described as everything in the past has built up. And the trigger point of the accident just tipped me over the edge. And I don't agree with it. It's a really difficult thing. That's why I just thought, well, FND, yes, it's a diagnosis, brilliant. But if this is in my head, whether it is or it isn't, I thought, well, if it is, I can control that. And because on a scan, there's nothing physically wrong with me. Like if you're epileptic, you'd have scarring on the brain tissue and stuff. So you can see that you've had a seizure. With me, there isn't. Yeah. With anyone with FND, there's nothing there to show there's anything wrong. So if your brain is that powerful and it's causing all these different symptoms because of traumas or stress or whatever the reason might be, then surely that you can take that power back somehow. It's just finding out how. And I did. I just thought, well, if it's in my brain, I'm going to fix it.
Completely makes sense now that you've explained
it that way.
There's
no right and there's no wrong. And there's people with FND who walk around like me, and there's people who have FND who are hospitalized and will never walk again.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that just because if they've got a positive attitude, they'll be fine, because that's not always the case, because it affects people in so many different ways. And there's trauma-based FND, and then there's like, you could get maybe catch FND through a virus. So it's very difficult. It's basically a misfiring of the brain, however that comes about. It's hard to explain. And I sometimes feel I'm one of the lucky ones. And but I don't want to preach and just say, have a positive mental attitude and you'll be fine.
Completely.
You can't walk, but we'll book you in to climb that mountain. Because it doesn't, you have to. I do believe that everybody can get better than they are now,
mm-hmm.
with the right attitude. I do think it's 10% treatment, 90% kind of mental resilience. But not everybody can tap into that, can they?
It took a lot of courage for you to share a video recently of you experiencing seizures. And I'm just wondering how it felt to post that and what the response was.
I instantly regretted it when I posted it. Because one thing telling people you have seizures and another thing people seeing you having seizures. And I deliberately picked that one because it was a fairly mild one. I was very aware and I didn't want to upset people. You can put trigger warnings on, but if you've never seen a seizure and it's a really violent one, that can be really upsetting. And I didn't want to cause it. So I deliberately kind of toned it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because I felt like my page was all positive. I'm doing this, I'm climbing this, I'm going for walks, I'm doing this. But nobody really saw the days then when I can't do things.
Mm.
And I felt like I needed to post a bit of that. And I still feel like I need to post more of that, because I only post the positive things that I've overcome rather than what I'm dealing with.
Does it feel like a responsibility to post the ins and outs of it?
No, but I think if it's going to be a fair reflection, a fair idea of what FND is, it's only right. And I think I feel like it does some sort of injustice to people who cannot walk because of FND or they are bedridden. If I feel it in a way that if I'm just posting, I've got FND and I've climbed a mountain, it feels a little bit like I'm rubbing people's noses in it, rather than actually FND is very real and this is also very real part of it, not just what I've overcome. That's why I feel like I need to do both, because most of the time it's bad, you know.
Yeah.
I don't go a week without having seizures. I don't go a day without having seizures, but nobody ever sees that.
And that's why you shouldn't have any regrets for all of those reasons that you've just said. And I guess it takes us back to that statement I made about catching yourself when you're feeling a bit negative and you are overthinking. And, you know, I experience posting things online and thinking, oh, do I look too preachy? You know, have I repeated this from the other day? Are they thinking, oh, get over it? Or, you know, you do think that way, but it's so unnecessary.
Yeah, people don't think that though, do they? Because if you post something today and then you post something tomorrow and then you post a similar thing 3 weeks later, the chances are people probably won't remember what you posted previously, or there'll be different people looking at it. But to you, because you're the only person posting on your page,
mm-hmm.
it just feels like you're doing it more too often.
Yeah.
You judge yourself, don't you? Rather than how other people see it.
Completely. What was the timeline between the accident and then the wheelchair use? and then I'm assuming learning to walk again before you climbed a mountain.
The accident to wheelchair was probably 6 months. And then from wheelchair to walking with like a frame, maybe another year or so. And then from that point to climbing the mountain was about 4 months.
Wow.
But in between that, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer as well. So I kind of got, I got better to start walking, preparing for the mountain climb. I broke my foot. I recovered from that 6 weeks later, ready to start again. Then I got a diagnosis.
Gosh.
So I had to kind of, yeah. So in reality, I did about 6 weeks training to actually climb the mountain.
Gosh, you've been through so much in the last, what, 3 years? Can you see how inspiring it is, how you open up about your story and see how helpful that can be to men in particular?
Sometimes.
Good.
Yeah, good. I do sometimes.
And I know we were planning on speaking about mental health more so today, but regarding your cancer treatment, I have to ask, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I had chemotherapy yesterday morning. Hopefully that's the last lot. I've got to have kind of scans again in a few weeks' time to see where we sit. So yeah, I take it day by day because the first time round I got my hopes up. Yeah, great, been operated, had it whipped off, sorted, good now. And then it happened again, and it's like, oh, okay. And then a few weeks before I got told I'd have to have more chemotherapy, we assumed it would be done until the scan was done, and it had just not done what it needed to do. So we had to have another couple of rounds of chemo. And if it doesn't work this time, then it'll be an operation, which and then starting all over again. So try not to think of that. I posted a video yesterday, me come out of the hospital, happy as Larry, treatment done, because that's how I'm viewing it. My treatment's finished now. Now it's just recovery.
Yeah.
And if I have to deal with it again, then I will. But for now, that's it. Yeah, it's done. Just recover now and then climb a mountain in May. I've always seemed to have a mountain to aim for. I have noticed that.
What's the next mountain you're planning on climbing then?
Penny Fan in Wales.
Nice. And do you do it on your own or with other people?
No, it's a group of people. It's through Rock to Recovery again. I've bonded quite well with quite a lot of people who do fundraising for Rock. So it's a really good bunch of people. You have such a good day out. You all have a meal at night time. You have drinks. You have laughs. Everybody just listens to you. And it's so many inspiring stories. It's crazy.
You mentioned that you never had friends, but more acquaintances. And I'm wondering if that's still the case now.
I've probably started letting people in more now. I've probably got 3 or 4 that people that I would class as a friend now that I actually open up to. And they are there for me on a regular basis. Friends, not really.
No.
No, I'm at a point where I'm starting to filter through people again, who's good and who's bad. And when you're reaching out to people all the time and you either get ignored or it takes weeks and weeks for them to respond, then I don't think they're your friends, are they?
No.
Because they don't genuinely care about you if they take that long. So and that's hard because these are people that I've grew up with, which I find really difficult to cut off.
Completely agree with you. Somebody said to me a few years ago that your circle of friendship goes like this and it evolves and people drop off of it and the long-term ones stay on it and they're the ones that matter. And then, but to contradict what I'm saying there, you know, the long-term ones don't always stay on it.
No, do they ever?
Well, that's...
You get one or two people who went to school with somebody and then stay friends with them forever and ever and ever. But it's rare. I think it's more female, the male side of things.
Yeah, completely. And I listened to a conversation on TV recently about relationships amongst men, particularly around circumstances of divorce and relationship breakdowns, where men rely on the women in their lives to have friends and to have people around them. So when those relationships with their partners break down, men can feel more alone than what women can. It's a generalization, but it made me feel really sad to think about, actually, because I thought, yeah, I can see what you're saying there.
It's true, though. It is what you do.
Do you think as men that we'll ever feel less uncomfortable about sharing our vulnerability? Do you think we'll ever be able to move past it the more that we talk?
We will.
I like to think the more that men like you and I speak, we're kind of opening up the conversation around our mental health as males. And I'd like to hope that that will help future generations, because it'll have some sort of domino effect in some way. And, you know, we might in the future see higher levels of mental health and lower levels of psychiatric disorders and so on, and even male suicide, if more of us men just start feeling more comfortable with talking. And I say this knowing that it is so hard.
Let's hope so. I think that's why we do these pages, though, because that's what we believe will happen.
Completely.
Otherwise you wouldn't bother, would you? You think, oh, what's the point?
Completely.
But no, I think so. I've got an 18-month-old son, and 100% I believe that he will be able to talk about what is on his mind. 100%. Yeah. And I've never really, because I, like you, I do a podcast. I haven't released, I think I've released one, but yeah. I'm working on that. But I have, and yeah, I do these. I'll come on podcasts, I'll chat to people about how I'm feeling. And if I sat down with my son in, say, 10 years or 20 years' time, said, oh, actually, yeah, a bit of a rubbish time, you'd glaze over it, as you would do father to son. But the fact that I've put my how I feel out there for him forever, it's you're almost leaving a bit of a legacy.
Yeah.
Because he will know how you felt as a man as opposed to how you felt as a father, because you naturally want to protect him as a father. But if he listens to what I'm saying, he'll know exactly how I felt at that moment in time.
That in itself is so inspiring.
I didn't think about it at all. And I thought, oh, yeah, the internet's forever, isn't it? But you don't think, do you? You just assume it comes and goes, but it's always there.
That is such a good point, isn't it? Well, I've really enjoyed this chat
today.
Yeah,
me too, Stephen. I was nervous. I always get nervous.
I don't know why.
And I ramble a lot as well.
I haven't picked up on any rambling at all, no.
That's this default ramble then.
So I ask all of the guests to give 3 top tips to finish off their episode. What are your top tips for living a healthier life?
Love yourself. I would say loving yourself is the most important, but it's the most difficult. And if I spoke to 10 people, 9 of those would not love themselves at all. But love yourself for sure. Because if you can't love yourself, you can't love other people. Don't be as hard on yourself, because whether it's an illness or mental health or whatever you might be going through, our expectations of ourselves are always a lot higher. So I think just kind of take it day by day, and just remember every day will be different. Maybe not better, but it'll be different. And always have a goal. Whatever that goal might be, it could be getting out of bed, it could be having a shower, it could be making yourself a cup of tea. It could be climbing a mountain, jumping out of an aeroplane, fighting a lion. It really don't matter. Just have that goal, and have little goals often. Because you've always, I learned quite quickly that setting a big goal and you can't achieve that goal, that has the opposite effect on you. So set these little goals. And it does. I thought, yeah, I could do this, I could do that. Yeah. Or, it took me 3 years to get where I needed to go, but I thought I could do it in 12 months. And you can't. So it's little goals, little and often is what helped me, and I think would help a lot of people.